Okay, it is 1:05 p.m., May 23rd, 2018. My name is Nani Swaminathan. I am 28 years old. I am a Master of Social Work student here at the Erickson Institute in Chicago, Illinois, where this interview is taking place, and I'm interviewing alongside
Victoria Largin. I am also an MSW student here at Erickson. I am 30 years old, and we are interviewing.
Andrea Goss. I am the project director of the DCFS Erickson Early Childhood Project. I am an Erickson alum and also a graduate of Loyola's School of Social Work. And I'm very happy to be sitting with these ladies today.
Thank you for meeting with us. So we were kind of in the middle of a little pre-interview chat. Kind of talking about the culture of the team that you work with. Mm-hmm. And you were asking what my impressions were mm-hmm. as I interned with that team during the last school year. And what I was going to sort of talk about was that as much as that sort of send-off celebration stuck with me, what also really had an impact on how I viewed the team and the culture that exists within that team was when one of the team members left for another position. Mm-hmm. And the experience that was created for her and for the team in her departure. Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit more to that and how that came about and why that exists?
So you are referring to Lynette's going away?
Yes.
Okay, yes, Lynette. Lynette was a screener on our project for a couple of years. I can't remember exactly how long she was with us. But it goes back to what I was talking about in our pre-conversation, and that's the importance of relationships. Because our focus, a big focus of our work is relationship-based practice. I believe that starts with our team. That starts with how we relate to and connect with each other. It sometimes is a challenge for folks because it creates a level of intimacy, or I wouldn't say a demand, but it requires one to be open and one to be open to making and establishing true connections that are born out of being authentic. So in that, beginnings and endings are important. So when people join our team, you know, we make sure that everyone is aware that they are coming. We do an introduction via email and in supervision. But we also, when we come together as a group, we do introductions. So it's not just, hi, I'm Andrea, welcome to the team. It's, hi, I'm Andrea, and this is where I come from. And, you know, it's we take these steps to really get to know the person, which actually starts before they join us. The interview process is a little insane. I'll tell you about that later. But with endings and beginnings being important to us and traditions, whenever someone leaves, we have a way of saying goodbye. You know, that's pretty standard. And so we have, you know, we schedule a day, we have food, we have, you know, some fancy water, what have you, whatever it is, you know, and we make it a festive thing. But I think what's different, and I'm not sure if you remember this, Victoria, is that we really encourage everyone to say something to that person. I mean, it's not like a demand, right? It kind of happens because, you know, say for instance, a person who is more talkative in the group, they would say, oh, you know, in Lynette's case, I remember when you joined and you were so nice to me and you were helpful. It's an opportunity to say goodbye because we know that that's important. It's important to kids, so it's clearly important to adults too. And so what we see at the end of all of that is the person having had the opportunity to hear from each one of her colleagues in, you know, in some way, some say more, some say less, and for them to say goodbye to each other. because their presence on our team is important when they're here, and their leaving matters.
And it facilitates like kind of like an ending.
Yes.
And a transition.
Yes.
Really, a big transitional
yes.
period.
Yes, absolutely. And wow. so we do that with when people leave. We do that any special life event, like baby showers. We do wedding showers. You know, just those opportunities to kind of celebrate folks, but also it's a way of you know, continuously trying to create a team atmosphere. I have a staff of 30 plus, and they're all over the state, and we don't have opportunities to come together very often. Mm. We do come together 4 times a year now, but you know, that's not often.
Is this what the culture has always been like since you've been here?
So I've been here for 18 years. It was 18 years in March. So no, when I started, we were a much smaller team. We didn't have any downstate staff. We were pretty, so most of my team are housed in DCFS offices. And so during that time, I was also, I have a DCFS office now, I just don't use it, but I was, most of my time was there. We were very isolated from Erickson. You know, we were kind of, we didn't belong to anyone at that time. So we didn't really belong to DCFS, and we didn't belong to Erickson. So we were kind of doing this, you know, kind of thing. We were very insulated and isolated doing this thing on our own in a much, with a much smaller team. And so around about, so my boss left, my former boss left, and then when Laura joined, that's when we started establishing more of a connection with Erickson, even though many of us were Erickson alum. We started having more of a connection with Erickson, and we started to do more of those things to kind of really focus on relationship team building aspects of it.
Have you felt like since having been here, congratulations, by the way, coming up on 18 years, have you felt like from where you were when you started to where you are now, do you feel that the work itself has been more effective, or that you have felt more effective, like now that the culture shift occurred?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's kind of yes and no, I would say. And it's an interesting question because of where I am professionally. So I'm coming off the heels of completing my 18-month 0-3 fellowship, and we also have a director, a new director. We've had a number of new directors at DCFS, but this particular director has been here for about a year now, and she's very focused on birth to three population. And so this is all going to come together in a minute, but really I've seen a big change in the way I think about the work, and in a way I think will make our work more effective within this last 18 months or so since going through the fellowship. So the way in which we currently operate, although I am slowly shifting and changing things, right? I'm influencing us to kind of think about things in a different way. But the way in which we've been operating for so long has been from a distance, right? We are Erickson employees who 95% of our time is dedicated to working for DCFS. You know, that's kind of hard to establish your identity, you know, and I've always said that when describing my position and my identity, I've always described it as my schizophrenic existence, because different settings require different things from me and different ways of being. So, so we operate at a distance, right? We are the ones who set the practice for birth to 5-year-olds. We are the ones who have this expert knowledge in regards to kids who've experienced trauma and adverse experiences. We have the developmental knowledge, and we come in sometimes in the very beginning of a case, and other times when something has gone completely off the rails. And that's when, you know, we're getting in there to try to make these wonderful, beautiful recommendations, even with our screenings. Mm. You know, we put a lot into that. I mean, these are the best screenings ever, right? But how useful are they if nobody is reading them? How useful are they if they don't translate to families being able to take advantage of whatever it is that we're offering? And caseworkers, it's not helping increase their capacity, because it's like in their world, everything is on fire. And we get to sit in this ivy tower in a place of privilege, right? And come in and basically try to convince them to do what we feel is right on a case that they're going to be stuck with until however it ends, and we're only there visiting. So that was something that I had to get to. I mean, you know, there were pieces that occurred to me, aha moments that happened for me before that, but it didn't all come together until, like, you know, this beautiful colliding of the director's direction and my 0-3 fellowship. It just kind of collided, and I'm like, oh, you know? And so I started practicing this, you know, with various people that I supervise. I'm like, so we've been doing this for a long time. And each time we talk to a caseworker or a supervisor, it's almost like it's the first time. Why is that? You know, it was so striking to me one day. We had to enter a case that was going very badly for this little baby, and we wanted to do a staffing, and I had two of my supervisors sitting here, and they're just like, you know, fix it, fix it. And I'm just like, well, we'll see. Let's go. Let's get her on the phone. So I called this supervisor, and I'm like, hi, this is Andrea from Erickson. And she's like, who? And so she's like, oh, okay, Andrea. And so then we started to talk, and it was almost like she had never heard any of these things ever before. Mind you, less than a week prior, there were 7 people at her agency, at her office, doing a training for her team. 2 of them were from my team. 2 of them were from DCFS, the waiver program. They were there with them for 3 hours doing a very elaborate training. It had all the information, and it was like it was brand new information. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there like, what do I do with this? And so that call ended. You know, in my mind, it was not successful. I mean, she said, okay, yeah, I hear you. Yeah, right, okay, but yeah, we got to do this, you know, which I understood, right? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the ideal situation for the baby. So, you know, I had to learn to let that go, you know? But it's situations like that, it's things like that, you know, there are numbers and numbers of situations, there's tons of data to suggest that, perhaps we need to do something a little differently here. Perhaps we need to fully and completely acknowledge our privilege. I mean, I've talked about it, and they can say, yeah, you know, we are. But no, to own it and to sit in that, because we have to own it, right? And that's the only way that's going to allow us to truly be able to engage and connect with the folks who are really in the line of fire, and they don't have the luxury of being able to check out like we do. Mm. So what that is going to look like, what our work is going to look like from this point moving on, I'm not 100% sure. But there are some things in mind that I have in mind, such as, you know, one of the things that we do is that we write these beautiful reports. They're so lovely. They're beautiful. Interpretations and everything. We make all the connections, right? Okay, we're going to scale that back, right? We're going to scale that back. You know, let's not allow perfection to be the enemy of the good. You know, it has to be accessible. It has to be useful. And if I can offer you one or two services or recommendations, as opposed to seven, something that will really change your life, you know, that will support you, something that you can buy into, something that I know you can easily access, then I'll do that and hold off on all those other things that, you know, are good, but they're just like, you know, is that exactly what this family needs in this moment? So that's one of the things we're going to do. The other thing is that we have been holding strong on our belief that, okay, we'll do the assessments, we'll, you know, based on that and the meeting with the parents and all this stuff, we will recommend, you know, whatever needs to be, what we think will be helpful. And then we will pass it on to the caseworker. Mm. We do the EI referrals, but the other referrals, you know, we pass that on to the caseworker. And we're not doing that. We're gonna do those referrals. And we're gonna track those referrals. And we're gonna follow up with the providers. And we're gonna follow up with the parents. And we're gonna follow up with the caseworker. We're going to stay with that case longer and provide much more support and help to kind of facilitate that referral actually sticking and work through barriers that may prevent it from sticking.
Than throwing like a bunch of phone numbers at someone and saying like, yes. Good luck. We wish you well.
Yes.
Hopefully this works out for you.
Yes. Now, like I said, with the EI referrals, we were doing those, but we weren't sticking. We would make the referral and like, all right, okay. Did you follow up with the EI provider? So no, we're not going to do that. We're going to stay with it a little longer. Yeah. I think, so those are just a couple of the things off the top that I can think of. And me and the supervisors are meeting and talking about it on a, you know, right. We have to process everything, but we're going to continue to work through it and see what that looks like and see what needs to be tweaked. And it's all, the work is not work if we're doing it for ourselves, right? You know, why I have a mantra like every 6 months or so. And if you guys have heard me talk before, I always say this. I have a mantra that typically changes like every 6 months, right? But I've had the same darn, and it's more of a question. And I've had opportunities to speak at different events and talk this through. So I use those opportunities as a way of processing what was coming up for me and trying to understand it. Come speak at this event. Okay, I will. And I just take that in. But it's more of a question. It's, why am I here? I've been here 18 years. And that's a long time to be in child welfare, not to mention the 5 years prior to that. That's a long time. A lot of people don't want to last that long. And I think I'm not done yet. I think there's a lot more to be done. And I just don't feel like I'm ready to go. Getting back to your question about being effective, I don't feel like we have been effective enough. And I think we can definitely improve upon that. And I at least want to get that ball moving before I can say, okay, maybe I can move on.
Mm. What brought you to this type of work? I can feel that you're quite passionate about it. Mm-hmm. And having spent time with you in some meetings, mm-hmm. you came to our intro class, which mm-hmm. students, I mean, almost 2 years ago, still talk about. you're speaking in that class. Like, it's easy to pick up on that from mm-hmm. you. So what brought you to this work?
I don't want to sound philosophical, but I'm really being honest here. I think that we end up where we are supposed to be. And so there are a lot of things in my history that make sense, make complete sense that I would choose this as my profession. Just tons of things. So I can go back, things that I wasn't even clear about. Of course, as a kid, I would not have been clear about. But I come from a very large family. And my mom has 10 siblings. I have two. So, but my mom's siblings, it's a bunch of them. But when I was a kid, there were always tons and tons of kids around. And, you know, my great-grandmother had bunches of kids around. And you know, my mom's, my grandmother's sisters had bunches of kids around. I had no idea until like maybe 5 years ago that they were foster kids. Mm. I had no idea. That was just cousin Jody, you know? And, but it's, what's really interesting is that that wasn't a part of our family's narrative, mm-hmm. right? So for me to not know mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. even as I had been in the field, you know, it was just a conversation my mom and I were having. Yeah, you know, and I was like, I had no idea they were foster kids. Mm-hmm. And so there's that piece of it. But and a number of things, you know, from my own personal history that have, you know, that's brought me here. I did the Moth Talk, remember? Do you guys remember that? Erickson had an event, a storytelling event that the Moth...
Oh, like the Moth Radio Hour.
Yeah. So Erickson had a Moth event, and I was one of the speakers. And, you know, we kind of had the creative ability to be able to construct our stories the way we wanted or needed to. But I remember when I was telling my story that as I was, you know, trying to recall it and as I was pulling it together, it was the scariest thing I've ever done in my life. But it all started to make sense because when I was younger, I was, I have a younger brother who's like 8 years younger than I am. So he was my kid. Right? Mm. I raised that kid. Like, my parents was like, "Ooh, okay, go ahead. Take care of your brother. Where are you going? Take your brother. Ooh, he's going to be late for school. You better take him to school." I mean, seriously. Well, did you feed your brother? You know, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. He was my kid. And so, when I was in high school, 16, you know, sweet 16, my aunt, who had been suffering for years from mental illness, had a severe breakdown, and her two little ones came to live with us. They were one and two, mm-hmm. going on two and three, but they were one and two. Anyways, those kids, I already had one kid, right? So those kids became a big part of my responsibility as well. And so I recall thinking about how that impacted my life and, you know, my freedom and me, you know, becoming my own self at the age of 16. And when I went away to school, I was like, deuces, you guys will never see me again. Trust me when I tell you I'm getting out of crazy town. And so leaving for school, I think I said to myself, well, I said often to not just myself, to lots of people, that I never wanted anything to do with kids again. I don't want to see kids. I don't want to know kids. I don't even want to know that they exist on this planet. Like, no, to that little population of people, absolutely nothing. Wanted nothing to do with them. And I meant that for a long time. And so I studied psychology at U of I. And I was, you know, trying to decide on graduate school. My mother was like, law school. I'm like, because she wanted me to do it. No, I don't like that. So I was kind of figuring it out, and I was just doing, you know, little jobs, working at a bank and whatever, other little stuff like that. I think I was, I did some other job I hated. It was almost like a construction worker, but it wasn't that. It felt like that. I did it for $5. I was like, this is not for me. And so, as the universe would have it, and I often say the universe, but I understand that it's something in me that has been developed and created by my own experiences that drew me to child welfare, right? So I'm at this car wash, a construction job, car wash, whatever you want to call it. It's one in the same. It was one in the same. It was, yeah, ridiculous. It was like Enterprise Rent-A-Car or something mm-hmm. or something like that, yeah. And so I'm there, and I'm not sure how I found out about the job at LSSI that I, that was my first job in child welfare. But some kind of way it came to my attention, and I applied for the job, and I got it. You know, but again, that's where I was supposed to be. That's the universe. Mm. Like, girl, put that brush down and get your butt out of there. Get out of there. And so that's when it started for me. And back in those days, I had, my memory was long and, you know, I was learning, but I was excited and I was really close and connected with my families. And I was just assigned a family of five five siblings, I believe, and each of them had some type of developmental delay, you know, and they were young. It was like two up until maybe 10. That might be on a high end, maybe like 8. But there were you know, delays and you know, learning issues that they all shared. And when I first went to visit them, they were living with their paternal grandparents. Lovely people on the west side of Chicago, just sweet, sweet older people who had no idea, right? Mm-hmm. And their parents were also DD. They were also DD, so developmentally disabled and substance users to mm-hmm. a degree. Not much, but, you know, just trying to figure it out. And so when I walked into this house, I remember this long hallway. So this house was like full of stuff, right? So there was this long hallway and they had clothes hanging in the hallway. So that made the hallway just really tight. And so I had to like squeeze through, you know, the hallway, and it opened up into this kind of 1970s living room with the French provincial furniture that's either pink or blue that's covered in plastic.
Okay.
Yes. It so reminded me of my grandmother's living room. It was fantastic. So it's quiet as a church. You know, it's so quiet in there, you know? And so she's like, oh, I'm going to go get the kids. And I said, okay. You know, so I'm just kind of standing, looking around, you know, taking it all in, just remembering, like, I remember that couch, you know, for my grandmother. And in walks these kids, and they, not even walk, they ran up to me, and it was five of them. They ran up to me, and they just kind of encircled me and didn't say a word. And they were looking up at me, and they were communicating something to me, and I just did not know. It was familiar to me because thinking back, when my cousins came to live with us, I had a moment with them where I was really mad at them, and I locked them out of my bedroom, and they sat by my door until I opened the door. And when I opened the door, they just looked up at me, you know, and that's exactly how these kiddos were looking at me. And it just took my breath away, you know. And, you know, they had these big eyes, and, you know, they had kind of these half smiles. And I'm like, what are they telling me? It was just, you know, there was no air in the room in that moment. And so that seemed to last forever. But what really happened is I started wondering, like, you know, I'm wanting to understand, you know, why is this, you know, affecting me? Because now I'm having a connection to my own cousins, and, you know. And so fast forward, I don't want to tell my whole moth story. But anyways, one of the reasons I came to Erickson is because I wanted to know and better understand how kids communicate. Nonverbal or preverbal kids in particular, or kids who are challenged in ways to communicate. I wanted to be able to understand that, and I wanted to be able to support that, and to be able to help their parents to understand that. And so Erickson gave me lots of language to be able to do that.
Did you ever make sense of what they were trying to say to you?
Yeah, there was such a need in them. There was so much neglect and deprivation that they had experienced. They were looking for someone who would be able to pour into them some of the things that they had not received. Especially some emotional and love and nurturing types of things. They were sweet kids. Mm. They were the sweetest kids ever. And they just wanted somebody to love them. Mm. That's what they wanted.
Yeah. Wow. It's a powerful case. Mm. Stick with you for that long.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Are there any other cases along the way that have stuck with you like that one?
Yeah, but not in good ways. Mm. Not in good ways. You know, I don't know what happened to this little baby after I left the agency. You know, but it's one of those cases that when it's one of those, I don't know if you ever have had experiences like prior to, you know, doing your master's study or whatever, and you've thought about things that you've done before, you're like,
yep,
should have done that. Oh, that wasn't good.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That was one of my cases. Okay. Yeah. I could have advocated much differently for that baby. And I didn't. And so as a result, the agency did some really weird things in terms of moving him around a lot. That wasn't good for him. And so it wasn't good for him. So I think about him sometimes.
Mm.
I remember his name clearly.
Do you feel like moments like that sort of change the work that you do today or drives you in different ways?
You know, it was reminding me why I have such a thing for multiple move cases. Those cases I will get into in a heartbeat. I will get into it with the director over those cases. Like, why are we moving this baby? Let's think about who the psychological parent is. Let's think about how this loss is gonna affect him. You know, let's think about those things, you know? Those things, they really get to me. So yes, I think it has a lot to do with that case.
Okay. So apart from obviously like the cases being incredibly difficult, the systems being stacked in a disproportionate way, like what to you has been the most challenging about doing this kind of work within those systems, and particularly as a woman of color in this field, what has brought you the most significant challenges along the way?
That's a great question. So over the last maybe 2 years, maybe 2-3 years, one of the things that has become more clear to me is that what our families face happens starts way before child welfare. And did you hear me do that talk? I don't know. Were you there when Molly McGrath was there and Judge Martin?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going back to that one. And a couple others I did. It happens the challenges start way before child welfare gets involved, right? So one of the things that I know for sure is that there is definitely systemic challenges that affect certain populations than others. I will say that I'm a product of the South Side of Chicago. And born and raised, I'm gonna always hold that, even though I'm gonna move one day, but I'm gonna always hold that as part of my identity, and that's always gonna be very important to me. So one of my girlfriends is teaching at a school in a neighborhood where I grew up. I didn't attend that school, but it's in a neighborhood where I grew up. And I sometimes am in that neighborhood, find myself there for, reasons, maybe to see her or whatever. The schools are underperforming, right? They're not resourced in the way they should be or can be. There are no jobs. There are no other resources in terms of mental health, substance abuse. I mean, it's just completely depleted. And I know that for people, and I'm speaking specifically of African American.
Ooh.
I'm sorry, that's the director.
Okay, we had to pause for a minute.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. We had a phone call. It was important.
Yeah. I just say that there are a lot of things that should be in place to support African Americans that's not in place in terms of it. People are not understanding why things are the way they are.
Mm.
So there are tons of reasons why people tend to struggle in certain communities, African-American and either other races as well, but there are tons of reasons why. And I do believe that there is a way in which they are not supported or given the opportunities that should be available to better their situations. Mm-hmm. One thing I completely hate is when people across the board just like generally say that folks should be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. I'm like, well, what if they don't have any boots, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it has to start somewhere. You have to be able to understand and meet people where they are, understand where they've come from, and then be able to help and support them to get to a better way of functioning, you know, with their input, of course. Yeah, so I'll leave that there. But I think you guys, was that clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
What are you proudest of, personally and professionally, in your life?
Oh, wow. That's a hard one. I think what really makes me proud professionally is when I can have a hand in supporting another professional in achieving their goals. So say, for instance, I love supervision. I love supervising because I love those opportunities to be able to sit with a person and see when the light bulb moment goes off. I love those opportunities to be able to help, you know, scaffold a person and, you know, kind of help them to be able to reach a different level and to build their capacity. I love those opportunities. I have a person on my team who's an Erickson alum, and years ago, she was in school when I was in school, so that was years and years ago. And for the longest time, she had no interest in going back to school, you know, for her MSW. And she's going next year. This year, she's gonna start in September.
Wow.
It's taken a long time. You know, she was, you know, not thinking that she needed it. She was like, no, I don't want to deal with it. I mean, but she really started to, in our like case presentations and in our supervisions, as you know, she's trying to figure stuff out and struggling with different things, she came to it on her own. She said, you know what, I think I want to go to social work school. You know, I want to be better able to do this work, not just for the clients, but for myself. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to be better at it. And so those types of things make me very happy. Professionally, what was the other part of that? The personal part I don't know what to say about that. Personally, I think the fact that I refuse to give up.
Mm.
I think that my ability to stick with it and be flexible, and actually let's be 100, that I am this Black woman sitting here in this position.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm proud of that.
You deserve to be proud of that. Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that until now, but okay, I'll take it.
Yes, absolutely.
So this is a question that I really like a lot.
Okay.
And I borrowed it from, I don't know if you've ever seen Inside the Actor's Studio with James Lipton, but
yes.
He has these 10 questions that he always asks. I'm not going to ask
yes.
you your favorite curse word, don't worry.
Okay.
My favorite question that he asks people is, if you could have any job other than your own, what job would you do? Because we spend so much of this time talking about the universe, and you in and of yourself felt a compulsion and a desire and a motivation and almost a magnet to do this work.
This is going to sound really sad, what I'm about to say. It's going to sound really sad, but it's still social work, okay? That's
okay.
Why it's going to sound sad. Because I created this job in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
It exists. I seriously believe, stop it. I would be working alongside Tom Dart in the Department of Justice, working with incarcerated fathers, mm-hmm. Who have young children at home.
Mm.
So I created this job in my head. I swear to goodness, it's crazy. But yeah, I mean, to think about the impact of losing, you know, your father or a father to the criminal system, and you know, the impact to the child, the impact to the parent. And so the idea is to interrupt those patterns, right? So if we can start with the kids of those men and provide support and education and support, you know, those types of things, then perhaps we can stand a better chance at interrupting patterns, and they don't end up in the systems like, you know, like their fathers.
Wow.
Ain't that weird? It's so weird.
It's not weird.
It's like, you know, if I had a dream job, that's what I would do. Yeah.
Do you see yourself maybe moving towards that in the future?
Maybe. It's all in here. Nobody else knows about this but me.
Well,
not even
as soon as Tom Dart hears this interview, you're going to have that phone call.
Make it happen.
So I guess we have 4 minutes.
Okay.
They weren't supposed to call me. It's okay. Hi, this is Andrew.
You are very busy, and these phone calls make total sense.
It's okay. A lot of people ask for your time. You've got a lot going on.
So
all the more we appreciate you taking the time
to talk to us. Yeah. So in the last 4 minutes, I guess our last question is, like, what have we not talked about that you want to share?
That I want to share. Well, actually, I do have a question. You guys have been so great, and you have been so thoughtful, and you were concerned about me as the interviewee, and I'm wanting to know, and you said that you were nervous. So
yeah.
I'm curious about that, because, you know, I've known you guys, you know, so I'm wondering what's driving that concern and kind of worry a little bit.
Can you answer that in 3 minutes? Because I can't.
I think that I can answer it very briefly and may have to explore some of that more in a therapy session. I think that I was nervous because I have interacted with you through my internship, through class, and I so respect the work that you do and you as a person, that we haven't done this before.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't nervous sitting in the meetings and on Mondays beyond the first couple.
Mm-hmm.
But this interaction is new. And so it feels different, and that makes me a little nervous, gives me a little anxiety, but I feel great now.
Okay. Now that it's over.
Yes.
Now that it's
like 10 minutes into it, it felt better. And I have so many more questions for you.
Do you?
I mean, just not, like, not today,
yeah,
not
we
right
can
now.
Always do a part two.
If you have time in the next year or two,
of course we'll be around. Of course I do.
Yeah, there's just, you're doing such amazing work, and you are a fascinating person.
Well, thank you. Well, okay, so here's the thing. And I know it takes time, but I never want you guys to be nervous around me or anything like that, because I feel like I've connected with you guys, and I think it's just talking.
No, I for sure. I don't disagree. I think for me, it's someone shared a story with me yesterday about you lending them your phone charger.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. In the way that she told the story, it was very just like, just take my phone charger. Like, don't stand there, like, holding the that seems ridiculous,
right.
You know? And she used the term effortless generosity to describe you. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's it. That's what you, and that's from that first day you walked into that 1 week intro to social work class with Tanya to now. there's an air of effortless generosity that you carry yourself with that puts me in this position of just like, God, how do you do this work? How are you capable of all of that and still effortless generosity? Yeah. Wow. So I guess in these last 27 seconds, thank you for being who you are at Erickson, being who you are as, you know, Andrea. Thanks for agreeing to do this interview with us.
You guys are so kind. Thank you. I will do anything for you guys. You may have to chase me down to get me. That's true. Know that I am not always available. But I will do anything for you guys. So you're